The correct Eastern Standard Time is now 9:30. The best informed people listen to CBS Radio. And now, update. Shouting defiance of the Western powers, Gamal Abdel Nasser is enthusiastically acclaimed by hundreds of thousands in Egypt, storm center of the Middle East. With the eyes of the world focused on both Eastern Europe and the Middle East, CBS Radio presents Update, a special series of concise, comprehensive, and documented reports on significant forces in today's world. Each week at this time, you'll hear the facts on challenging questions of our time, the political story, the military story, and the human story, recorded by presidents and diplomats, by refugees and reporters, by the men and women who made yesterday's history and today's headlines. Update. Tonight, Egypt, in the second of three programs about the Middle East. Here to bring you up to date is CBS News correspondent Stuart Novins.
Students of Egyptian history stress one theme. For the bulk of the population, life today is strikingly like life under the pharaohs. Most Egyptians lived in mud huts then. Most live in mud huts today. Then as now, the typical Egyptian farmer, or fellah as he is called, waged an unequal struggle with poverty, hunger, and disease. In Pharaoh's day, the peasant had no recourse to modern techniques or medicines. They didn't exist. Today's Egyptian peasant is still deprived of modern techniques and medicines, although they do exist in the world around him. He is too poor to afford them. When Egypt's current president, Gamal Abdel Nasser, promised to end all this and to change life in the Valley of the Nile, he was hailed as a hero, as the savior of Egypt. Egyptians have felt that their aspirations to develop themselves were frustrated by foreign domination. In particular, they referred to the recent influence of the British Empire. When Nasser defies those identified with former oppression, the vast crowds demonstrate their thundering approval. Like three out of four Egyptians, the president was born in a mud hut village. He is the product and leader of a movement to lift Egypt out of past squalor. Some Egyptians say that a new Egyptian age breathes in him. What is this new Egyptian age, and what are Egypt's aspirations for the future? Well, to begin with, one aspiration was realized in 1952, when the Albanian dynasty, represented by King Farouk, was overthrown by a revolution. For the first time in 15 centuries, Egypt had a ruler who was a true Egyptian. Nasser was a leader of that revolution. And he has said that the action was motivated by the desire to put six principles into effect. This is how Nasser summarized those principles in an interview with CBS News correspondent Howard K. Smith for the CBS television program See It Now.
You know, our revolution was based on some principles. These are the six principles which were declared in the Constitution. The first principle is to get rid of colonialism. Second principle was to put an end to the feudalism. Third one was to put an end to the influence of the corrupted capitalists. Fourth one was to have social justice. Fifth one was to have a national army. And sixth one was to have real, clean democracy.
This was Nasser's promise for the future, and Egyptians seem to have been impatient for this future to arrive. There has been a ferment of desire, a demand for quick results, and a profound sensitivity about the remaining signs of the country's backwardness. Foreign observers in Egypt have mentioned that Egyptian crowds sometimes become hostile toward photographers who take pictures of a dismal slum, a ragged beggar, or any other indication of the country's heavy poverty.
I'm sitting in a little open-air cafe in one of the back alleys of Cairo, the old part of the city built 1,000 years ago. It's noontime on a Muslim holiday. A troupe of wandering street musicians across the way has begun to perform.
Yalla,
Men in long striped robes are sitting at small tables, sipping tea or smelling bunches of mint, smoking 2-foot-long pipes, or telling their beads. Foreigners don't come to this part of Cairo. Of course, I'm accompanied by an Egyptian friend. Street peddlers are moving among the crowd, selling cakes, combs, flowers, cards with messages from the Quran painted on them. The Arabs are famous for their hospitality to strangers, and a few minutes ago, a woman peddler came up and insisted on presenting me with a gift of a handful of peanuts and a handful of watermelon seed. Now, it looks as though we might have some trouble here. Someone is objecting to my making this recording, apparently, and my friend is arguing with him. I guess I had better stop the recording now.
That was how the recording ended, abruptly. Here is Stephanie Dinkins now with her explanation of what happened.
This was not an unusual experience in Egypt, but it's not limited to Egypt. The Arabs in recent years, since the creation of Israel, have become particularly sensitive about bad propaganda abroad. The Egyptians want foreigners to look at their fine new buildings, not just the picturesque old sections of the city. They want the outside world to hear about the new Egypt which they are building.
Egyptians want the foreigner to know that they are building, but new buildings in the cities contrast strangely with the medieval slums clustered alongside. As for the farmer, he barely subsists. Most of those who have jobs earn very little by Western standards. Here is a blind Egyptian weaver. He sings because he has something to celebrate. He has been told that the government will give him a vending stand so that he may sell newspapers in the street. He says that he expects to become a millionaire, for the new trade will raise his income to $1.40 a day. Aspiring to rise from poverty, the Egyptians face basic economic problems. What is the root of Egypt's difficulty? We have asked this question of Professor Charles Issawi, a Lebanese-American who teaches at Columbia University.
Egyptian agriculture is per acre the most productive in the world. But so many people have to share the produce that each gets only a tiny amount. In an area the size of Maryland, you have a population of 23 million, four times as many as in Texas. Until very recently, land was very unequally distributed in Egypt. Less than 1% of the landlords owned over half the total cultivated area. Agricultural production can be increased in Egypt only by building very large-scale irrigation works, such as the projected high dam near Aswan, which, if built, would be by far the largest in the world. Of course, it involves a huge cost, some $500 million or more. That is far beyond Egypt's capacity to finance by itself.
Despite the hardship and the lack of money, Egyptian youth has aspirations of its own for the country's future. Abdelmonen Shawki is a social worker, dedicated to helping his countrymen toward a decent life. Shawki tells of an assignment he had to help a community in Cairo solve its pressing health problem. The people needed a clinic.
The people decided to have a clinic. The land was very expensive and scarce. I was asked to help. One of the members said, "Why don't we start it on our mosque as a second floor?" Everybody objected, and one of the members said that how can people pray while screaming is upstairs in the clinic? The other said, "How can we start a clinic on a mosque? What people will say about us? It's not our tradition to do something like this." In the meantime, I went all over meeting the leaders of groups. It took us about 3 or 4 meetings until at the end they decided to have the clinic on the mosque. There are other mosques in Cairo now which have clinics and more activities as part of the mosque. I don't remember how many groups used to knock at my door early in the morning and late in the evening just to express their gratitude. I wish to see that every community in Egypt have a social worker who try to help the people to do something for themselves.
Children are not excluded from having aspirations of their own. Here is a 12-year-old boy, son of a poor farmer, who walks 2 miles to and from school every day. He says that he worked in the fields today, taking care of the animals, and then he walked the long distance to school. He desires very much to read and write, for then, he says, he may write a letter if he needs to, or he can read a letter if he should receive one. Also says the boy, when he looks for a job, he may be asked if he can read and write, and he wants to say, yes. He wants to get and to do a good job when he grows up. An ambitious and dramatic governmental scheme to raise the standard of living was the so-called Liberation Province. Claire Sterling of Reporter magazine describes the nature and progress of this design.
Northward and westward of Cairo lie the 1,200,000 acres of desert known as Liberation Province. On these parched and barren dunes where nothing has grown for 5,000 years, NASA has undertaken to create 200 villages, each with 200 neat concrete bungalows, with shops and parks, a mosque and school, a marketplace and water tank, a drainage system and electric lights, a public bath and post office, even a machine shop to service the mechanical equipment that would, for the first time in 50 centuries, banish the camel and donkey from Egyptian fields. And in this vast new province, which would add a fifth more to Egypt's usable land, he has pledged not only to settle 500,000 fellaheen, but to mold them into an ideal society, healthy, happy, educated, efficient, and free. In 1953, Liberation Province was planned to cover 1,200,000 acres. By 1955, that figure was cut in half. By 1956, the project was described officially as open-ended, with only 10,000 acres under active consideration and a year's budget of only $12 million. This year, the budget allotment has been cut to $3 million. And because of the economic strain caused by the Suez crisis, even this figure was reduced by 10% a few weeks ago. NASA blames his enemies, the British, the French, the Israelis, for forcing him into these cutbacks in the interests of national defense. Many Egyptians believe him. Many others do not. They believe instead that this project, like so many others, has been sacrificed to the growing ambitions of a dictator who has abandoned the social revolution at home in his search for glory abroad.
Some Egyptians say that Nasser himself is the embodiment of their aspirations. Other Egyptians say he is far from that, but that he is a useful instrument in the realization of their dreams. What about the man himself? What drives Nasser to act as he does? John Badeau, past president of the American University in Cairo, and now president of the Near East Foundation, was in a position to observe Nasser and Nasser's effect on others. Here is Badeau's appraisal of Nasser.
The first time I met Colonel Nasser was at the American University at Cairo during the early days of the revolution. Is the Nasser of today the same young man, or has power and success turned his head? Both Nasser and the events which made him are too complex to be written off in a single trite phrase. What is Nasser then? First, he is a true revolutionary, consciously speaking and acting for a new Egypt. If he is sometimes intransigent and belligerent, and he has been both, it is partly because revolutions are intransigent and belligerent. But Nasser is also a strong man. Some people would call him a dictator. But that is using a Western term for what is really an historic Eastern pattern. Nasser appeals to Egypt as the embodiment of what the revolution stands for. That is why they do not consider him a dictator. Nasser himself is quite clear about this. "I'm not a dictator," he said recently to a British correspondent, "for I rule with the consent of the people. I'm an authoritarian." Nasser is also an Egyptian. He is the first true Egyptian to lead the government of Egypt in over 2,000 years. Finally, Nasser has an army mind. He makes head-on attacks against such problems as social progress in the country or solving the status of the Suez Canal. And he also has a certain naivete in approaching the complexities of social reform and international relations. What does all this make of Nasser, you ask? Well, he has called himself a young man in a hurry. Perhaps that is his basic problem. Maybe he's trying to do too much, too fast.
Nasser is frequently charged with being a dictator. When he appeared on See It Now, Nasser justified the kind of regime he has set up and gave his explanation of how it came to be that way.
We thought, after the success of the revolution, that we have to cooperate with the party of the majority. For getting rid of the king, we got touch with the parties. And we asked them that they have to put into effect our principles. And we were not able to agree about the second principle, that's to put an end to the feudalism and limit the ownership of the land. I met the Secretary General of the party 2 months after the revolution, and I told him that we feel that in order to raise freedom in the country, every individual must feel free. And we don't feel that 18 million people in this country are free. This is the farmers, because they are under the complete domination of the landlord. The landlord can dismiss them at any time, and they cannot say anything against his will. We tried to put into effect a law which limits the ownership of the land, but we failed. And so we decided to take the government by ourselves.
It has been charged that Nasser is ambitious to become the leader of the entire Arab world. The Egyptian broadcasting station, The Voice of Cairo, is said to foster Arab nationalistic emotions and to fan the flames of anti-Israeli feeling. This common hostility toward Israel is one of the ties that binds Egypt to the other Arab states. And the existence in the Middle East of the 900,000 Palestine Arab refugees is a reminder to all Arabs of the unsettled dispute between Israel and her neighbors. Shafira Das is an Egyptian student who made friends with one of the refugees. She tells about her friend, Majed.
Majed studied at the university with me, and he was a Palestinian boy who had come with his family from Palestine. They had no money at all. His father had owned a ceramic factory in Palestine, had been wealthy, a big house, a garden, lots of fruit trees, and now their house can be seen across the barbed wire from Arab Jordan. Israelis live in the house and pick the fruits off the trees. Majed had to work at nights so as to be able to pay his tuition during the day at school. He felt very bitter that here he was, a stateless person. His roots had been pulled out. He didn't want to take a passport in Egypt because that meant that he would give up forever his right to his home in Palestine, and that his dream was to go back and live in the house that his father and his great-grandfathers had lived in.
Nasser has said that Egypt's position on settlement of the Arab-Israeli question agrees with that adopted at the Bandung Conference by all Arab states. For the main points of the Arab position, here is Fayez Sayeg, acting director of the Arab States Delegation's office.
We look upon the settlement of the Palestine problem as predicated upon the outstanding resolutions of the United Nations, namely, the repatriation of the Palestinian refugees who were expelled by Israel from their homes, the internationalization of Jerusalem, the abandonment by Israel of the excess territory it holds, and the return to the boundaries and the frontiers drawn by the United Nations when it decided to create Israel, and the humane treatment of the Arabs who live today under Israeli authority. Let Israel accept in principle these resolutions of the United Nations to be what the United Nations intended it to be when it decided to create it, to correspond to its birth certificate, as it were, and the settlement of the Palestine problem will not be then unattainable.
The problem of defense against Israel was discussed by Nasser in these terms when he was interviewed by Howard K. Smith.
Until February 1955, we were feeling secure, and we withdrew all our troops really from the Eastern Front. Suddenly, there was a raid, planned raid, against Gaza. 36 of our troops were killed in cold blood. Next day, the Israeli Defense Minister, Mr. Ben-Gurion, congratulated Struss about this action. This was a turning point. The result of that, we are feeling that we are neglecting our armed forces, concentrating all our efforts towards the production. And we tried really to give more attention in order to be secure.
Claiming that Israel was a menace, Nasser tried to get arms from the West. Meeting failure, he concluded an armament deal with the Soviet bloc in September of 1955. Following this, the West refused him financial aid for Nasser's project to build the high dam at Aswan. Then last summer, Nasser took over the Suez Canal from its Western managers and nationalized the canal company. This caused repercussions on a global scale. In the meantime, Israel had charged that armed raiders from Egyptian soil were carrying out repeated terrorist raids. In October of last year, Israel invaded the Sinai Peninsula to wipe out the bases for these attacks, and Britain and France occupied Suez for the expressed purpose of guarding the canal. This entire question is now, of course, before the UN. The Israelis had claimed that much damage had been done to the Egyptian armed forces. Here is Hanson Baldwin, New York Times correspondent, discussing the state of Egypt's military strength.
Egypt probably lost about 85% of her jet aircraft in the fighting of 2 months ago. Her army's strength approximates 100,000 men. And in addition, she can mobilize the virtually untrained but fanatic forces of her so-called National Liberation Army. It is estimated that the arms Egypt had received by last November the 1st from Czechoslovakia and Soviet Russia were valued at about $350 million. And Egypt's scarcity of dollars and pounds was forcing her more and more to make purchases behind the Iron Curtain. Continued communist military aid to Egypt will tend to increase Soviet influence in the Middle East. Communist technicians and advisors will follow the arms. Finally, Soviet military help to Egypt conditions the Egyptians psychologically.
That question of Russian influence has been dealt with by Nasser himself. He says,
Russia has no history in this part of the world. We were always subjected to British domination, British occupation, and British colonialism. You think of Russia trying to dominate this area. We think of the colonialism domination from France, for instance, in Syria and Lebanon, from England, for instance, in Egypt, Sudan, and Jordan, and Iraq. And so, if you want to secure this part of the world, you must give great attention to the historical background, the national aspirations, and the psychological complexes. We are afraid of any domination.
During this program, we have been examining certain Egyptian aspirations as the Egyptians themselves see them. And now we ask, what do the Egyptians really want from the West? John Badeau, who lived in Egypt for almost 20 years, recalls a revealing conversation.
When I left Egypt in 1953, I had dinner with a group of Egyptian friends out at the Heliopolis Palace Hotel. When I get back to America, I said, I shall be asked to speak about Egypt. What do you think I ought to tell my fellow Americans about your country? One of my oldest Egyptian friends finally said, look, Badeau, if you want to tell the Americans something, tell them this. Tell them that we're more than Suez Canal. We are more than a treaty of mutual defense. We're more than oil wells. Tell your Americans that we are people. The Egyptian people, like the rest of the people in the area, have hopes and aspirations. The hope of becoming truly independent. After decades of colonial or semi-colonial rule, the young nationalist desires to be free and independent, to do what he wants to do on his own soil. Then to this I would add the deep and growing desire among all classes of people in Egypt and in the Arab world for a new and better society.
Today, a key issue that still divides Egypt from a large part of the outside world is the disposition of the Suez Canal, which Egypt thinks ought to be nationalized. Here is the Egyptian point of view on how to settle this issue. This is Mohammed Habib, Egyptian press attaché in Washington.
Egypt is working for the restoration of the Suez Canal. to its pre-aggression status, namely a link of goodwill, cooperation, and constructiveness, and an efficient artery of world trade through which freedom of navigation is maintained at all times. This is Egypt's intention, and surely her efforts and her cooperation with the United Nations in the present clearance operations of the canal demonstrate this intention. However, there are still some well-informed people who refer to the nationalization of the old Suez Canal Company as a seizure of the Suez Canal. Most of these people know very well that the action taken by the government of Egypt on July 26, 1956, was a nationalization of an Egyptian company under a right that complies with the very ABC of international law. One way to build up a healthy atmosphere for peace would be for all people to start calling things by their true names.
Where do Egypt and Nasser go from here? Well, here's one answer reported by CBS News correspondent Winston Burdett.
President Nasser is politically as strong as ever after all the upheavals of the past year. War and diplomacy have failed to shake his grip on Egypt, and military defeat has failed to dim his prestige in the Arab world. His tangible losses in this past year have been tremendous. He has lost his effective military forces in the field. He has mortgaged his economy to the communist bloc for the sake of weapons that are now in large part destroyed. He has lost the possibility of new sources of foreign capital, which Egypt desperately needs. The marvel is that his propaganda machine has been able to turn it all into a great national victory in the eyes of his people. Nasser has converted a military defeat into a political triumph. Some diplomats there see new possibilities in the present situation. Egypt's economic need was never so desperate, and this alone may compel Nasser to turn westward. Only one country, the United States, can give him help on the scale that he needs. Perhaps Nasser realizes by now that he has gotten in too deep with the Russians. Certainly, one thing that the past year's crises have brought home to several Arab statesmen is that they can never hope to match Israel militarily, except with Russian help. And this means going down the road that leads to Russian arms, Russian technicians, Russian volunteers, and Russian dominance. It is not a happy prospect, and obviously many Arab politicians would much prefer American dollars. But if Nasser needs American help, he is fully aware that America needs him in the bigger power conflict. He may well go on trying to get the best of both worlds, getting dollars from Washington and arms from Moscow.
Gamal Abdel Nasser has been asked, what can the United States do to improve relations with Egypt? This was the answer.
You have to understand the psychology of the people. It is not with the economic aid, because, you know, in this part of the world, we are sentimental, and we give more attention to relations and the behavior more than we give attention to the material aid. Sometimes you give us economic aid and it will be again the object, because sometimes we feel that this economic aid may be for domination. If you will be successful to understand us from the psychological point of view, there will be no obstacle to stand between cooperation and friendship between your country and my country.
This is music which few Westerners will recognize. It's the Egyptian national anthem. A young Egyptian said this to a CBS News correspondent. One of our aspirations, a symbolic one, is to have the Egyptian national anthem recognized when it is played. It would mean, he continued, that we have taken the place we want among respected sovereign nations.
You have been listening to Update, another in a special series of documented reports on challenging questions of our time. Tonight, in this background report on Egypt, you heard the voices of presidents, diplomats, refugees, and reporters. Your narrator was CBS News correspondent Stuart Novins. Portions of this broadcast were taken from the CBS television program, See It Now.